Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Are Midwestern voters taking their midterm cues from President Trump? On one of the last days of the 2016 campaign, Donald Trump flew into the upper Midwest for campaign rallies, and the national press asked, why is Donald Trump in Michigan and Wisconsin? Well, now we know why. Trump would be the first Republican to win Michigan since 1988, and he edged Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin by 22,000 votes. Since then, the president and the vice president have come back to the upper Midwest a number of times.
Moments ago, we broke ground on a plant that will provide jobs for much more than 13,000 Wisconsin workers. It's really something.
Thanks to the good people of Minnesota for all you've done to not only stand with us in the campaign in 2016, but to stand with our administration every day since.
And Vice President Pence is back in Minnesota today for a private fundraiser for a Republican congressional candidate. So, our question this hour: what kind of effect is Trump having on voters, and how will that shape the midterm general election? Two guests for us and your thoughts, too. If you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, I'm looking for all the way across the political spectrum here today. Does Donald Trump loom large in your decision about a candidate in the primary? Is it more about local issues? You're not thinking about the president's effect that much. Or is he really a factor, a motivating factor for you as a voter because you want to send the president a message? So talk to me about how you see these midterm primaries as we head into the general election and where the president really fits into your political dashboard. Want to hear from Republicans, Democrats, independents? Talk to me about where the president fits, his priorities and yours, and where they meet. 800-242-2828, anywhere in the region, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter, at Kerry, it's K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Catherine Pearson, is a professor at the University of Minnesota. She specializes in American politics. It's really good to have you back. Thanks, great. Catherine, for coming.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
Aaron Brown is a political commentator and a community college instructor, and he's based in Duluth, and he is with us today in Balsam Township. Hey, Aaron. Hi. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie.
Catherine, I thought it was interesting to go back and read some of the reporting a week out from the 2016 election. I saw your face when I played that tape from, why is Trump coming back to Wisconsin in 2016? There was a lot of puzzlement about why the president was spending so much time in Michigan and Wisconsin. And here's what the New Yorker wrote, their political editor, wrote on Halloween. The big challenge facing the Republican candidate is that in recent elections, as many as half of all white working class voters hadn't voted at all. But that conceivably is also an opportunity. If these voters could be persuaded to show up at the polls in large numbers, much larger than the pollsters are expecting, it could make a big difference, especially in places where there are a lot of them. That's what happened,
and
isn't it?
That's exactly what happened. So in Michigan, Trump won by nearly 11,000 votes. In Wisconsin, he won by about 23,000 votes. And obviously, those were critical electoral college wins that propelled him to the White House. And so these are incredibly important states, not just swing states in presidential elections, but also critically important states in midterm elections. And if you look at the percentage of whites without college degrees nationwide, Trump did better than any Republican president had before in those states in 2016.
So, Aaron, what we know happened in 2016 was that the president activated a group of voters who had not been necessarily politically active. Now the question is, do we see signs that those voters are remaining active, or they've kind of slipped back into the, I don't know if I'm going to participate or not? What's your sense of that?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to figure how much of what happened in 2016 was what you describe, new voters, white, non-college educated voters. There was some of that. But I think, at least here in northern Minnesota, where I'm from, and the Iron Range gets a lot of the attention here because it's the DFL bastion, the labor bastion that then voted about 50-50, but gave Trump a first historic win in almost 100 years in some of these Iron Range towns. And some of that was situational around the demographic realignment of the region.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that as we've watched our economy change due to automation, due to the aging of the working class towns of the Iron Range, we've watched the liberal progressive tradition of those towns kind of change too. You know, when the DFL became a force on the Iron Range, there were four or five times as many miners working here. Today there's about 3,000, and they produce the same amount of ore, of iron ore, as they did back then.
Yeah.
And the workers who work in the mines are now highly educated professionals, technical positions. They learn code. They learn how to code their machines. So, you know, so it's a very different profession. These are now among the highest paid workers on the Iron Range. And yeah, they were really amped up about the tariff issue, trade issues with China, and that was right in Trump's wheelhouse, and it obviously worked for him. I would also suggest that Hillary Clinton was a historically unpopular political figure on the Iron Range in 2016. Mm-hmm. You look at the numbers, Trump did better than Republicans typically do, but there was a huge drop-off on the votes for the Democratic ticket
because of Hillary's
weaknesses. And so you had a lot of third-party voters. I mean, a friend of mine voted for our friend's dad who used to buy the beer back in the day. You know, he wrote a guy's name in, you know. And these are people who typically voted Democratic and for various reasons opted not to vote for Hillary.
Okay.
And the attitude towards Trump was give it a shot. The worst that could happen is nothing around here changes. And
let me do this. I want to take some calls because we have a number of people that want to get in on precisely what you two are saying. A listener on Twitter says, Trump and the Republicans want to cut my pension. I'm retired federal law enforcement. So, yes, I'm very motivated to vote this year. And to PJ in Sauk Center, hi, PJ. How are you seeing the president's influence on the issues that you care about?
Yeah, I'm an independent who supported Sanders. I actually left the presidential ballot line blank this last election. I think that he has resonated with the FL part of the DFL party, and I honestly think they better figure it out or they're going to lose congressional districts 8-1, and my goodness, even 7 could be at risk. I don't know what they forgot about, but they certainly forgot about farmer labor rights. No doubt about that.
You're saying, hey, message to Democrats, you're missing a big part of your constituency here. Yes,
absolutely. And the state party, unless they nominate Waltz, I think will absolutely lose. The problem with Clinton was that she was actually, she actually ran ads saying that she was favored by more Wall Street leaders than Donald Trump was. We'll go figure that out. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what the consequences of that are.
Hey, thanks for the call. Catherine, what do you hear in that?
I hear something that's happening not just in Minnesota, but nationwide. If you look at sort of the changing demographics of the Republican and Democratic parties nationwide, and it is the case that it whites without college degrees overwhelmingly voted Republican across the country, not just in Minnesota. And that was really a new trend in terms of the Democratic coalition in 2016. Interestingly, the few parts of Minnesota that did go a little bit more blue in 2016 than they had in 2012 were some of the inner ring suburbs. And so we are seeing this shift in Minnesota, but also nationally.
I was reading that piece, I think it was in Politico today, about how important the suburbs are going to be.
Yes.
Are a lot of these suburban voters people who have been active all along and we see them in some of these cases lining up against the president? Or well, are these, yeah, or who are these people?
Well, swing, a lot of the swing districts, certainly not all, but a lot of the swing districts in the 28 midterm are suburban districts. Suburban districts that some went for Clinton, some went for Trump, but elected Republicans, often Republican incumbents to the House, and now they're facing a constituency with whom Trump is not popular at all. And so I'm thinking of people like Eric Paulson, who himself has won by large margins in the third.
Right.
But if you look at the third district in 2016, it went big for Clinton by almost 10 points. And so we have here an incumbent who was running for re-election, who has been popular, but facing a constituency who really dislikes the president that he supports.
Call here from Marilyn in Bloomington. Hi, Marilyn. How does this look to you?
Well, you just described me. I have been a Republican and all my life until 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at candidates now, if they are so aligned with Trump, I'm not going to be voting for them. I need somebody who's going to be able to stand up against him and look for a leadership that's diplomatic, that's not divisive. And, you know, I would love to be able to stick with Republican, but I'm not seeing those leadership characteristics.
So, Marilyn, for me to be clear here, for midterm candidates, your test is, are you standing in line with President Trump? Then you're not my candidate. Is that right?
That's correct. And I'm leaning towards Democratic because I don't see the divisiveness. I see some, you know, candidates that are more aligned to what I want to see in my policymakers.
Really interesting. Glad you called. Aaron, you know, the Republican base, you know that the president still remains highly popular with the Republican base. Are there more Marylands out there than, you know, get noted by pollsters, or is this something unique to our area? What do you think?
Well, I think here in the 8th District that it is a very Trump-friendly Republican party up here. There, I certainly know a few. I have colleagues who would say what Marilyn just said. You know, moderate Republicans have had a harder time in the last 10 years and are now gravitating towards Democrats. And so, yeah, I think that's true. And I would also point out that there's a lot of things happening in regional centers. Now, you were talking about Rochester earlier in the hour, and I would put Duluth in the same category, a city that is, you know, a little more diverse and actually turning more liberal. So there's a lot. Like, that's why I say a lot of this is realignment and change, and we don't quite know where it's all going to land yet, because while the range might be trending a little more conservative, Duluth is going the other way. And we'll see what the rest of, for instance, the 8th District, where do the rural exurban places go? A lot of those places have had some buyer's remorse on Trump, and so we'll see what happens.
You know, Catherine, as you know, Farm Fest is going on and tariffs have come up. And this is where the president seems to be on some potentially dangerous ground here. I want you to listen to what he said in the campaign trail about trades and tariffs. And then let's match that up with what he's done.
I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator, which should have been done years ago. Any country that devalues their currency in order to take unfair advantage of the United States, which is many countries, will be met with sharply. And that includes tariffs and taxes.
So I want to ask you both, if that sounded good in campaign rhetoric and looks a whole lot different today to the people that supported the president. So, Catherine, you weigh in first on that.
Yeah, yes, I think it did sound good to many in campaign rhetoric. And one of the notable things about President Trump is, in terms of much of his campaign rhetoric, he has either done or tried to do what he said he would. A lot of which is at odds with sort of tradition Republican policies and positions. But nonetheless, a lot of what he has campaigned on, he has either tried to do or actually accomplished. And I would put tariffs in that category. And it's hard because to some extent, all politics is local. So to the extent that farmers are being hit hard by tariffs and they can feel it in their pocketbook, well, that matters and may give some a reason to vote against the president. On the other hand, in our country more generally, we're witnessing a period where partisan identification is extremely strong. And for many, even if the policies are not policies that they would come to on their own, something being supported by the party leader, in this case for Republicans, President Trump, is going to be favored by the party.
So Aaron, maybe that explains why there were people in the crowd when the president was saying that in the Midwest who were going to be hurt by that policy and are now being hurt, who thought that was a great idea when he was talking about it on the campaign trail.
Yeah, well, it sounds good. It sounds like America first.
Yeah.
And I think that's the story behind the Trump phenomenon is he crafts a simple message that certain demographics have really responded to. They've responded to it very well here on the Iron Range. And of course, steel tariffs have gone a slightly different direction than the farm tariffs, because unlike the farmers who are actually hurting because of the tariffs, steel industry has done very well this year. And here on the range, all the mines are running. That's typically when the mines are running, everybody's happy. When the mines are down, everybody's sad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a little unfair because the recovery started before Trump was elected. And it was really economic factors create the strength for the steel industry that really make it last and make it do well. But Trump got a lot of credit for those tariffs. And they're certainly helping these companies make a lot of money. Like U.S. Steel, Cleveland Cliffs, these companies are having their best years in a long time because of policy that not only captures the good economy that started a while ago, but also just ramps up the profits with these tariffs that are driving especially domestic customers to domestic steel.
Of course.
It's very beneficial for Trump in the upper Midwest, wherever there's a steel mill.
Of course. Exactly. Good point. Because if you're a company that needs steel, right, to make your products, you're not making it, but you need it,
mm-hmm.
your bottom line isn't looking so good because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're paying
more.
Yeah,
and that's where manufacturers have suffered. Harley Davidson and other examples in the Midwest, these manufacturing companies are suffering because the steel costs more money. Right now, rolled steel is over $1,000. It's extremely expensive per ton, and that's an enormously high price. The market doesn't support that for too long. And the danger here is that we're playing with a potential recession that would actually shut the mines down quicker than anything.
What do you think of that, Catherine?
Well, I think... Yes, if the mines were to shut down and people really felt it quite strongly immediately in their pocketbook, that would matter. And increasingly, midterm elections are a referendum on the president rather than the actual candidates who are running. And so when I say a referendum on the president, sort of if people are punishing the president, they would also punish his party. And I think we're seeing that both economically with some of the tariffs we're talking about and then in terms of Trump's overall approval for some and disapproval for others.
You also said increasingly. Has it not always been that way?
It has not always been that way. If you think back to former Speaker Tip O'Neill, all politics is local, that was really true for congressional races for a long time. But in 1994, when Democrats lost the House for the first time in 40 years, in-depth analyses of voters' vote choice really revealed that a lot of that was about disapproval of President Clinton, voting Democrats out because a lot of districts didn't approve of President Clinton.
Mm.
Fast forward to 2006, President Bush was historically unpopular. Democrats retook the House of Representatives in that year. And then, of course, everyone remembers 2010 when President Obama himself said that Democrats took a shellacking, I think was the quote. And President Obama at that point was very unpopular. And so with every midterm that passes, not just these years where Congress switches parties, we are seeing increasingly nationalized elections.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say that some popular incumbents can't insulate themselves. Colin Peterson has done that for many years. But increasingly, districts vote for the same party of the president as they do their congressional representative.
It's a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, for us to assess on this day after some pretty key primaries in states like Missouri and Ohio, about the effect that President Trump is having on midterm voters, the way they're seeing their primaries and then on to the general election. Does he loom large in a lot of decisions that midterm voters are making? And that's the question I'm putting to you. How does he influence, if at all? I mean, maybe for you, it's all about some individual issues, and that's how you're going to vote. That's how you'll support or not a candidate. But is he having an effect on the way that you are viewing whatever race you're going to be voting in, especially with the primary and then the upcoming general election. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter here, NATO says, almost never mentioned Ray Trump in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Trump only got 1,800 more votes in Minnesota than Romney, and he got 2,500. Catherine's looking at her numbers to make sure this is right, and got 2,500 fewer than Romney in Wisconsin. Perhaps his popularity wasn't what it seems here. Different in Michigan and Pennsylvania, he ran well ahead of Romney there. Are the numbers right, Catherine?
That sounds roughly right to me. But I think the more important comparison, though, is just how well Trump did in Minnesota in 2016 relative to past election. Mm. Think back to 2008. President Obama won Minnesota by 10 percentage points. And so there's just no doubt that Republicans, you know, gained ground in Minnesota in the 2016 elections. That said, if you look at the most recent NBC poll in Minnesota, we can see that only 38% of Minnesotans approve of President Trump, where 51% disapprove. And so, you know, this is more fluid going into the midterms.
Let me note this before we go to the calls here. NBC Marist, is that what you were just talking
yes.
about? Okay. So Midwest late June, some small margins of voters who think the president should be reelected. 60% of voters in Minnesota want to replace him. 52% in Michigan wouldn't vote for him again. 63% of voters in Wisconsin wouldn't vote for him again. I know those numbers might look quite different in a head-to-head matchup,
right,
as we get to the general. But what do you see in those numbers?
Well, I see a president who is not as popular as he should be given economic performance. So a lot of analyses recently have come out that have shown sort of other presidents with similar facing similar economic conditions have been more popular. So sort of given the state of the economy, Trump should be doing better, both nationally and in the Midwest. And so a lot of people sort of say, you know, why haven't Trump's actions hurt him? Well, they have. They have in terms of his overall approval ratings.
Even in the midst of a very good economy.
Yes.
Yeah. To the phones to Rick in Mankato. Hi, Rick. What's your what are you thinking about here?
Well, just kind of give you I voted Trump in, but I think it's kind of when you said send a message to Trump, that kind of spurred me to actually make the call. And it was, I don't think he's going to hear any message. I don't think he's politically based like that. He pretty much goes his own way, and that's the way he's always been. And to me, that was kind of what he does what he says he was going to do. Mm-hmm. That was why I voted for Ventura as well. I don't like politicians. I don't like politics. And I think the DFL has gone off base in that's they play the game, but I'm not sure that they go beyond that at all. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think you've picked up an interesting thing here, that even if the president loses, you know, the majority in Congress and the general or in the midterm general, you're saying that may not influence the way that he continues to govern and to be.
Right. And I'm not a partisan person. I'm anti-partisan. I think it's divisive. I think it does nobody any good. And I think that's what he was. He seemed to be, at least to me, an answer to nonpartisanship. And I think it's indicated through the fact that you have never Trumpers in his own party. Mm-hmm. I think he knows how to anger a whole bunch of, in my opinion, the right people. And those are people that have been, career politicians. And I think the idea of that is silly as well. I'd rather return to statesmanship. And I'm not sure that Trump, obviously, is the one true indicator of that.
I gotcha.
But he is, in my opinion, not a politician. I don't think he's he knows how to play people and all that, but he doesn't need it. He doesn't need a politician. He's got his own thing. And so I think, to me, that was refreshing. It was better than the alternative. And unless the Democrats come up with a viable alternative, I think you're still going to see the same thing happen again, in that if the option is another Hillary Clinton-esque or someone that they offer up, these people who are saying, I would never vote Trump again, are probably going to be forced to say, well, Jesus, they're probably going to have to be forced to vote him in again if the options are Clinton.
Rick, thanks for the call. You know, Aaron, I hear Rick kind of acknowledging that the president is a pretty imperfect vehicle or messenger for a lot of things that voters think is important. And part of that is breaking politics the way it is today. Now, do you hear voters in your part of the state talk about that?
Sure. I think Rick very accurately described the Trump's appeal to a lot of people I know. You know, the question is, you know, I think people are looking for authenticity. Politics is inauthentic in the way it's presented. I think our multimedia society makes it really hard to acknowledge what's really happening in politics. We're bombarded by persuasive messages all the time. And so they want something that stands up as true. And in that election, you know, I think despite the many problems with Trump, with the things he said and his record and the incendiary comments he made, if you could look past that, and some people could, they saw him as somebody who at least would smash up the works, right, and change things. Maybe not for the better, but at least we'd have to rebuild something in its place that we would prefer. And I think that was the appeal. I think what's happening now is we're looking at this and saying, boy, I don't know if this is better. Some things some people like better up here on the range. They like the tariffs. But the constant chaos and confusion trying to watch or listen to the news each day becomes a chore that challenges our emotional well-being. That kind of stuff is wearing on people. And so, you know, whether they vote for Trump again, yeah, probably does have something to do with the next Democratic nominee or the individual nominees in different districts around the state. But it's certainly being challenged. But I think he accurately described a lot of people's attitudes, yes.
Let me grab a call here from Stephen in Eden Prairie. Hi, Stephen. How is the president influencing the way you see these primaries and then the midterm in November?
Well, I'm not a Trump fan, and I voted for Eric Paulson in the past. But watching Congressman Paulson do this contortion around emotional issues that hopefully provide him cover from anti-Trump feelings, but there are issues that really don't matter as much. So I've watched this issue of character really playing out in increasingly disturbing ways across the spectrum. But locally, you know, my friends and I talk about this stuff. We're just really impressed that the politicians are really trying to polarize, stay in the polarization, but try to avoid being associated with Trump. And it's just an interesting dance to watch.
You, Stephen, thanks for the call. So, Catherine, this is something you were alluding to earlier, which is what do you do if you're up in a midterm in a district where there's some really polarized feelings about Trump? You're of the same party. Eric Paulson's in this situation. What do you do?
Right. Well, I think many of the things he's done have been to distance himself from President Trump. For example, signing the discharge petition to force a vote on immigration issues. But nonetheless, you know, his opponent will still be able to point to his overall voting record. So I think it's very difficult because on the one hand, the Republican base in the district will want a Republican member of Congress to be loyal to the leader of the party. On the other hand, so midterms are about mobilizing the base, but they're also about swing voters as well, especially in an election where there's so much interest.
And ultimately, isn't it true that when we're not, and I know we're always in an election season here, but when we're not, you know, when the election isn't just months away, Eric Paulson can be relied upon mostly to support the president's priorities. I mean,
yes,
if you look at his voting record, that seems to be the case.
Yes. If you look at his presidential approval scores, they're pretty high.
Yeah. A call here from Don listening in Iowa. Hi, Don.
Yeah. You know, you guys were kind of talking about what I believe, and that's that I'm a total supporter of President Trump because he's doing things that nobody's ever talked about doing before. China has always cheated on trade. The whole canceling the Iran nuclear deal. And now you see that there are some problems going on in Iran. I mean, what if he ends up being right? You know, sometimes when things aren't working out so well, you do have to go 180 degrees the other direction. And I just feel that a lot of people aren't giving him enough time to see where this is all going to end up. And so, no, I'm totally a supporter of Trump and will only support people who support Trump, because mm-hmm. we need to follow this through and see where it ends up.
Yeah. So, Aaron, that probably sounds familiar to some of the voters that you talk to in your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The question is whether you believe him or not. The question is whether you think he has your interests at heart or whether he's in it for himself and his political movement. And it pretty much comes down to that's whether or not you're a Trump supporter right now. You know, one of the things that earlier caller brought up, this idea about labor and Democrats need to pay attention to labor or those votes are going to go Republican. One of the ideas that I talk about is that, you know, the original labor movement on the Iron Range was about quality of life for workers. What labor has come to mean in modern politics is whether or not there are jobs because employers need the labor, which is a slightly different equation in people's day-to-day lives. And so when we talk about tariffs and when we talk about environmental regulations, for instance, as things that would help workers, mm-hmm. those things, you know, going Trump's direction on those things has really helped corporate profits in those industries. But we have yet to see how it's going to impact workers. And I think for Democrats, the goal with labor is, and maybe not necessarily to mirror what Trump is doing, but to find a way to actually improve people's lives. I think that is the thing everybody wants. And some people believe Trump can deliver that, and a lot of people don't. And we talked about approval ratings. And here in the 8th District, yeah. for instance, Pete Stauber running for Congress, his vote take will be exactly what Trump's approval rating is. If it's above 50, he's going to win. If it's below, he's going to lose. And it's that close.
Wow. I've been looking at some photos from Danny O'Connor's headquarters, this big district in Ohio that everybody's watching so closely. I think still up in the air. And Ron Brownstein, who I follow and is super smart in politics, writes about the Ohio 12, like last year's big Democratic wins in Virginia and Alabama, again suggesting that the Trump era is producing a new normal in American politics defined by greater polarization along almost every possible front. So, Catherine, when I think about what that means, I also wonder, where's the end of it? I mean, I know we've been here before. You specialize in American politics. What usually changed the path that we were headed on that feels like this?
Right. So the intense polarization that we're feeling is not new. It's certainly been coming for a long time, since the late 60s, early 70s, and it's just accelerated with the sort of the better sorting of the party. Conservatives are now Republican, liberals are now Democrat. You know, Democrats, there used to be a lot more ideological crossover between the parties. The politicians have become much more polarized. And then with President Trump, the rhetoric has even increased in its partisan intensity. Sort of add to that different news sources so that Republicans and Democrats aren't even getting the same set of information and facts. So we are at an extremely heightened era of polarization. Again, not new, but heightened during the Trump administration. And I think it will really take either, and I don't know how we would produce this type of candidate, this type of leader, leaders that are less polarized and want to work together. And in this current environment, I don't see that as being likely, or some exogenous shock. You know, yeah. Does the U.S. get attacked? Does the U.S. go to war?
And like a terrorist attack.
You don't
or
wish
something
terrible to happen to the U.S., but it's at those times when polarization actually goes down.
Aaron, do you ever wonder what this, you know, what this is all leading to? What stops it? What intervenes to stop this? I'm sure you think about this.
I think about it constantly because I would like it to stop. I took a family trip up to Canada, and you know what's on the news in Canada? Bears. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I think it will take something big. I don't know that we've seen with the Iraq war that war doesn't necessarily keep this country all moving
true.
In the same direction the way it did in World War II. I think Vietnam on it's a divisive thing. An economic collapse could at least clear the deck and maybe something new. I as a college teacher, and I'm sure the professor might agree, I have some hope in the next generation. I believe they're very frustrated growing up in this and watching this play out, and now they're adults and they're
yes.
voting. And I think a new generation of leadership might go a different direction in terms of how we talk to each other, in terms of how we relate to one another. But it's going to take something big, because right now there are so many calcified, hardened attitudes about politics that are just deeply unproductive, and there's just no stopping it, because once somebody is that firm in their position and their approach, they're unlikely to change.
You know, what's interesting is Catherine said earlier, Aaron, about how aligned we are with our partisan identifications. Now, how many people will you talk to who will say, I don't really like the parties, I don't like the way politics is set up, but who nonetheless end up voting party line? You know, I think there's a lot of pride around being an independent who nonetheless usually vote the same party. You know, what we do and what we say and how we feel about the political environment we're in, you know, it doesn't add up in a lot of ways.
Yeah. How we vote is a story about ourselves. You know, that's every time we go to vote, we're saying something about ourselves. And we'd like to be independents who have a free and open mind. But typically we're locked into a narrative.
Catherine?
Agreed. I mean, if you look at the survey data, people who initially identify themselves as an independent when asked, if there's a follow-up that says, do you lean toward one party or the other, and they identify a party, that accounts for the majority of people. There are very few independents, but then those independent leaners vote reliably with the party that they say they lean to.
I mean, the other thing is because we're always in election mode, it just seems like even President Obama experienced this, right? This huge mandate to support President Obama in 2008, and then pushback from the word go. I mean, it almost feels like there is no moment for the person that's been elected to actually do some of the things they say they're going to do. Although President Trump has been doing this through executive orders, and he got the tax cut through.
Right.
But, I mean, this is, I think, part of the reason for such paralysis.
Well, that's right. And there, of course, are institutional constraints, the need for 60 votes in the Senate. President
right.
Obama was most successful for that sort of brief window when
right.
he did have a 60-vote Democratic majority in the Senate. President Trump has obviously never had that. He only has 51 Republicans right now.
What's the big question you'll be asking yourself about the midterms as you watch this unfold?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think everyone expects, given President Trump's sort of surprisingly low approval ratings, given the state of the economy, not given some of the things he's said and done, but given the state of the economy, you know, will there be a Democratic wave as there was a Republican wave in 1994, in 2010, and a Democratic wave in 2006? Will there be a wave? And to what extent will there be sort of, you know, a Republican wall that will prevent the wave in some other places? So while we do see that Democrats are very enthusiastic about the midterm, we also see that solid Republicans are enthusiastic about supporting President Trump, too. And so I think the extent to which we will see a Democratic wave, and we will see Democratic pickups, it'll be a question of to what extent can enthusiastic Republicans forestall that? Because usually during waves, the party that doesn't do well isn't that enthusiastic.
Yeah.
And in this case, we see enthusiasm on both sides.
Aaron, I have a minute. What's the big question you're asking yourself about this?
I'm looking right at our own state. We have at least five districts that could shape the control of the House of Representatives. I think Democrats, if they're going to prove that there's a case against Trump, they have to win the House. There's no moral victories. You know, we're watching the results in Ohio, and they may turn out
Kansas.
One way or the other. But for the most part, a close loss doesn't mean much. So a close loss in the House, if they can take the Senate, that's a heavier lift. Otherwise, the president will continue doing what he's doing, and those who like that will enjoy it. And Democrats will have to go back to the drawing board. So it's a very important election for the response to what the president's done so far. And you can't ignore that it's the most important thing, I think, on people's minds.
Aaron, thanks much. Good to talk again. Catherine, thanks for being in the studio.
My pleasure.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.